This episode of the MGMA podcast is brought to you by Walmart Business. It's the Walmart you love, now for business. Get everything you need for your staff and patients in one place. Enjoy big savings on health and safety products, cleaning supplies, over-the-counter medications, and much more. And don't forget the break room snacks. Create a free account today and start shopping at business.walmart.com. That's business.walmart.com. Introducing First Call Triage, your ultimate remote medical staffing solution. With their office hours nurse triage line, front office services, including appointment scheduling and insurance verification, and back office services, managing medication refills and prior authorizations, First Call Triage can streamline your practice's operations. Plus, their remote patient monitoring and chronic care management ensure comprehensive patient care. So make the right call. First Call Triage is the first and only call you need for efficient, cost-effective, and high-quality medical staffing. So visit their website at firstcalltriage.com to revolutionize your practice. Again, that's firstcalltriage.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Women in Healthcare Podcast hosted with MGMA. I am so excited to have Dr. Lucy McBride here, who is a practicing internal medicine physician in Washington, D.C., and she's been seeing patients for over 20 years. During the pandemic, she became a nationally recognized voice of the importance of addressing mental and physical health, and she is the author of a popular medical newsletter, Are You Okay?, which now reaches over 28,000 people a week and is the author of a book about whole person health. She also hosts a top-rated podcast called Beyond the Prescription, where she interviews guests like she does her patients, pulling back the curtain on what it really means to be healthy. And she has been published in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, The USA Today, and appeared on NPR, CNN, MSNBC, and many others, talking about evidence-based medical advice, as well as just really advocating for holistic approach to healthcare. And we're going to be really excited today to kind of dive into all of that and what that means of becoming a whole person as a physician, as a leader. Now she has opened her own medical practice with a partner. And so really just diving into that. So Lucy, thank you so much for being with us today.
Adrienne, thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Absolutely. Well, let's just dive right in. Tell us a little bit about your journey into medicine and kind of what led you through the path and how things maybe shifted, if they did shift for you during the pandemic. And
sure. So I always was interested in problem solving and science. And at the same time, I was always interested in the things you cannot measure, the complexities of human nature. I grew up in a big family where my mom is a psychotherapist. I had my own quote unquote journey with physical problems that were had everything to do with stress. And you know, it was clear to me not until my 40s or maybe my late 30s that our bodies keep the score and that there's no partition between our brains and our bodies. You can't opt out of having emotional and physical health together. Like it's intrinsic. So when I went into medicine, I thought I wanted to become a doctor because of the problem solving, the logic. And it became clear as I started seeing patients that patients are more than the sum total of their cholesterol numbers and their weight and their number, the number on the scale. They are the integrated sum of their behavioral health, their emotional health, their lab data, their genetics, their family history. And we talk a lot about in medicine, you know, I trained at Harvard Medical School and Hopkins, and it's all rooted in this concept of evidence-based medicine, which is basically using data to drive our decision-making, right? About medical interventions, recommendations. It became clear to me when I started seeing patients that evidence-based medicine is essential, right? We don't just put our finger in the wind and make decisions based on, you know, whim. evidence-based medicine also includes the patient's story. The best evidence in clinical medicine comes from the patient, him or herself. The patient's story, meaning the things that happened to them, the fixed unpleasant realities of their lives, like how they were raised. Did they grow up in poverty? Did they have an alcoholic father? Are they a middle child who was, you know, neglected? And then the genetic realities of people's lives as well. So in other words, the beauty of what I get to do now every day in primary care medicine, in the way I've constructed it in my new practice, is being able to pull the curtain back on what it means to be healthy. So instead of just treating people like a set of boxes to check, a set of labs to analyze, and then shipping people on their way and saying, you know, eat healthy, exercise more, get sleep, you know, do better, chop, chop. I get to talk about the whole person and think about how their childhood trauma, for example, just, you know, being bullied on a school bus, for example, relates to their relationship with food today. They are a stress eater. They you know, walk around with shame about body image. And that relates to their blood sugar and diabetes and cardiovascular health. And so for me to take care of patients, it's not just about prescribing Lipitor for cholesterol. It's about understanding the root causes of where this high cholesterol comes from. Maybe it's genetic. Maybe it's completely out of someone's control. But maybe it stems from a relationship with food that stems from childhood. And maybe it's both. So my podcast is called Beyond the Prescription for a reason, because it's about seeing people from a 360-degree point of view, which is actually what I thought I was going into when I decided to become a doctor. But we'll talk later about why that isn't always possible in the current medical system.
No, I love that. Well, and I think that's so, as we talk, we'll talk about, you know, building your teams or working with different groups and those kinds of things too, as you've opened your own practice, you know, really understanding the entire person and why someone's responding to a situation or an event, or, you know, in this case, how it's impacting their health. It really is like what's underneath that. And often it may not be, sometimes it's large traumas and sometimes it may be, as you mentioned, kind of those smaller things that have happened that have continued to stay with us.
That's right. I mean, we talk about trauma a lot. It's sort of a buzzword and we should, right? Like, in other words, you don't have to have been in the Vietnam War or in the Iraq War or have watched the Twin Towers on 9/11 fall down in front of your eyes to experience trauma. I mean, life is hard. Life is full of disappointments and, you know, micro traumas and challenges. I mean, my point is that whatever you call it, whether it's a big T trauma or a little T trauma, our experiences in our lives, our stories, some of which we control and some of which we had no control over, have everything to do with the way we think, feel, and behave in the world. And when I mean thinking, feeling, and behaving, I mean, how do we conceptualize what our health is, who we are as, you know, living, breathing entities that, you know, we assume we want to live a long life. We also, in medicine, sometimes don't think about quality of life. We think about quantity a lot, right? Like, my job is to help you live longer. But what about thinking about how you think, feel, and behave every day in your life and how that relates to the choices you make with sleep, exercise, work-life balance, you know, other relationships with alcohol and food, and how those inform your quality of life and not just your quantity of life.
Yeah. No, I love that. And I'm going to get the details wrong, but I know you've shared stories where you've had patients who, you know, you're really talking to them about like, what are you trying to shift? And is there an event or is there something that they have to look forward to? Like, what's going to be an underlying driver for that change to get them there versus just, okay, like, let's lose weight or, you know, get
exactly.
your cholesterol down.
Actually, well, it's a lot like what you do in your work, Adrienne, in so far as the hardest part of my job and the most gratifying part of my job is helping people affect change.
Yeah.
So we all as human beings have habits, behaviors, routines that sometimes serve us, right? Like, sometimes we're doing the right thing. We floss our teeth. We, you know, get our checkups. We like take our medications, we take our vitamins. But we all have habits and routines and behaviors that are self-sabotaging, right? Like we drink too much. We skip the workout. We act out to our kids. We stay up late, right? We
power through that project until which is great.
Right. We do things that are not in our self-interest every single day.
Yeah.
We stay in relationships that are not healthy for us. So my patients who are in toxic relationships with, you know, neglectful or abusive spouses, like we all know the data on how easy it is to stay in a place of discomfort, even though we know we could be better, but change is hard. My point is that whether it's making a change with one of my patients or helping them affect change with regards to starting an exercise program, losing weight, leaving an unhealthy marriage or workplace for their overall health and well-being, that is the hardest thing for people to do. There's something called repetition compulsion. It's a Freudian concept where we do the same crap again and again and again, because it's like we know our own discomfort. We know our own discomfort more than we are willing to experiment with someone else's discomfort. And so we do the same stuff. So just like in your work where you're trying to help organizations and individuals affect change because of your experience and your expertise and subject matter knowledge, tell you the data are clear that this person would be better served if they quit drinking, or in your case, you know, hired a better process or whatever.
Yeah.
Supervisor, right? Or whatever. That is very difficult. So how do you affect change? And that's the biggest question that I ask myself every day as a human being myself who does dumb stuff all day long. I was telling you before we hopped on the recording that I was up late last night looking at Twitter, which is completely not in my interest because I didn't sleep as well and I had to have more coffee, and then my stomach hurts because I have more coffee. Right. It's all right. None of this is like malignant stuff, but there are parts of ourselves that self-sabotage every day. So in order to help people affect change, you have to drill down into what people, where is that coming from, and where's the resistance to change coming from as well? And then unpack that and then work with them on those changes.
Right. Well, and as you have, you know, transitioned to, I think people have to get to that core point, as you said, like it's from the persuader perspective, we need to help them unpack it and understand kind of what that core driver is going to be that's going to motivate them for change. And I know you left a larger practice and just recently in January opened your own practice. Yeah. What, you know, as you find with your patients or even for you, like what, is there something that people should be paying attention to? Or is there something that you see as kind of a pattern of like, you know, recognizing like, okay, I can't do it this way anymore.
This is actually what my book is about. And I'm in the process of writing it. It's a forthcoming book. I'm writing this book with Simon & Schuster.
Okay.
It's about evidence-based decision-making in our own lives.
Love it.
And it's about using medical data and our own data from our own stories to make decisions for our health and well-being. And I'm going to give people different stories and narratives about people who thought that their neck pain was about a pinched nerve, but it actually is about five other things. And here's, you know, they had to change job, whatever. But the essence of the book is this, the thesis I have, Adrienne, about health is that, and this pertains to health as an individual, like your individual health. It also applies to the health of an organization or an individual worker. But health, as I see it, is not an outcome, right? It's not a set of boxes to check. It's not a set of externals, right? We think of health in this country as, you know, 10,000 steps a day, sleep tracking, step tracking, a low carb diet, looking a certain way, and then having good cholesterol levels. Like that's what we think of health, right? Okay, fine. And those, you know, love exercise when I get to do it. Eating healthy, amen. You know, all those things are true. But health is actually not an outcome.
Yeah.
It's a process. And the process, whether you're an individual or an organization trying to be healthy, it's a process. I call it the three A's. The first A is awareness of the data being medical data in the case of an individual, and the data of your story. Were you bullied as a child? Are you a oldest child overachieving hypervigilant type? Did you have some experience as a child that was traumatic? Did you have cancer in your 20s? Did you have a bad experience with a gynecologist or with another doctor who shamed you about your weight? Like, what is your data? What is your story? And what is the medical data in your blood work in front of your doctor? And let's talk about, let's get that data. We need all that data. So awareness of the data is the first A. The second A is acceptance. This is the hardest part. So acceptance, take all that data that we just gathered, right? Things that happened to you, your cholesterol levels, your genetic predisposition towards breast cancer, and then look at them all. And we have to, unfortunately, accept the things we cannot control. We cannot control that we were bullied as a kid, that we were fat shamed, that our mom was an alcoholic, that we have a genetic predisposition towards Alzheimer's. We cannot change those things. Those are fixed. Acceptance does not mean throwing in the towel. It doesn't mean, oh, you know what? I'm going to get breast cancer and throw in the towel. It doesn't mean I'm going to be angry my whole life that this person bullied me and I'm going to live in an angry place. Acceptance is actually the process of liberalizing brain space to then lean into the places where you have the third A, agency. So when you have the data, you're aware of it, you have acceptance. By the way, that's a lifelong process, accepting things we can't control. Mothers, mothers-in-laws, spouses, bad bosses, the pollution, political unrest, you know, burnout, like all the things we cannot control. I mean, some of that we can control, but all accepting things we cannot control. Like, I have to work really hard to make a living. Like, we cannot control every piece of data that is part of our health experience. So, but once we can accept those parts, then we can work on the things. What are the parts we can work on? If you have a predisposition towards breast cancer and you have this unfortunate genetic predisposition, you have to accept that that is, right. It doesn't mean, but then you can get surveyed with mammograms, MRIs, sonograms. You can see a breast specialist. You can have the option of surgical prophylactic mastectomy. Let's say when you accept that your mother mistreated you and you were not loved and that caused you to have some relationship with food or alcohol that's inappropriate, you could stay angry at that person, but you could also accept that you cannot change that person. You can't change the past, and you also cannot change her. She is not going to change. She has showed you who she is. Your boss has showed you that he or she, let's pick he for a minute, that he is not going to see the value that you provide at work. He is not going to. And you could go to the hardware store for milk for 20 years and try to explain to your mother that you're a valuable person. Explain to your boss that you are providing value. You should get paid the same as your male partners. That may not happen. When you accept that unpleasant reality, as painful as that may be, then you can lean into the agency. Then, okay, maybe I need a new job. Maybe I need to work in a place where they value me. Maybe I do therapy to work on my experience of abuse by my mother, even though she didn't mean it, my anger. And let's channel that into your rocket fuel. Let's use that anger. Let's use that passion. Let's use your will to be healthy mentally and physically, to assess your breast cancer risk, to make a change in your relationships. That is hard, though. And that is the process of health. It is not an outcome. And it requires a lot of work, a lot of humility, a lot of support. And that's what I think I provide or try to with my patients. And that's why I'm writing this book, because this doesn't happen in a day or a week, right? It's a process that requires not just a doctor. You may need a team. It's like a support animal and a therapist and a really good breast surgeon. You may need trauma therapy and a yoga practice. The point is that health is a process. It's not an outcome. And it's about acceptance. And that is the hardest part of being human. It's a bitch. Acceptance.
I love it. Okay. End of episode. No,
that's the story. That's my book. I mean, it's kind of a no brainer. Like, here's the thing, Adrienne, like, yeah. There's no one I talk to about it who's like, oh, that's weird, because it's so obvious. But what is sad to me is that medicine in this country has become the opposite of that, right? It's become this algorithmic sort of depersonalized, out of touch with actually the human. Like, we treat patients like a set of, you know, organs, a bag of organs, a set of labs to check. We put them through, you know, like, doctors are sort of rewarded for, like, just testing and prescribing. And doctors don't want to do that either. It's just that the system is so broken. So, you know, it's sad that this is like a novel idea, right? That health is a process. It's not even novel. It's just, I've codified it and I'm writing about it, but it's, you know, it's kind of common sense.
Well, I think it's what I love. One of the things I loved about you said too, is just when you've gone through, and I've gone through many of these processes, whether it's health journeys or otherwise in my life, as I know you have too, of just recognizing, becoming more aware of like, okay, I'm reacting this way. I'm responding this way. I'm feeling this way. This thing is happening. Where am I contributing, and what has contributed to me responding to that? And then shifting to, okay, like, this is where we are. This is where I am. Mm-hmm. This is what I don't like about this. You know, here's the tension. John Maxwell just talks about like the law of the rubber band, right? Like where you are and where you want to go. And like, that tension is there, and growth.
Mm, yes.
I think sometimes we're told that growth is easy and it should be expansive and fun. And there's aspects of that that are true, but a lot of times it's really uncomfortable. And I think that's what I love about what you and Clay are doing with your group, of providing that kind of container to really help patients get from where they are to where they want to be. And over the course of time, it's not a, you know, single visit episode of care, where they're, you know, once a year, they really are kind of, you're on there. It's a process. They're on a journey and you're on a journey with them.
That's right. And it's also like, as I say to my patients, like, this is a, you know, without sounding like pop psychologist here, but it's like, this is a judgment-free zone. Like, patients feel so disenfranchised from the medical profession, and certainly the pandemic didn't help, and so disenfranchised from their bodies, right? Like, we've birthed this industry, this wellness industry, that is promising quick fixes and, you know, the guruification of medicine, as if there's some sort of like, you know, one guru or one supplement or gizmo that's going to kind of like, you know, fix your broken marriage and like make you better advocate for yourself at work and like fix your cholesterol and, I mean, solve your menopausal hot flashes and osteoporosis. I mean, it's just absurd, right? And so people are coming to the doctor often like having felt sort of betrayed by medicine and betrayed by their own bodies, because they haven't been given agency. They haven't been given the tools they need that are unique to them to solve their own problems, with guidance, of course. Like, I'm not talking about DIY medicine. I'm talking about using medical evidence. Like, we have a lot of medical evidence. Like, we evidence-based medicine is alive and well. Like, but evidence-based medicine has to include the patient's stories, the patient's vision, the patient's vision for their lives, right? So take a patient at the end of her life, a patient of mine who's in her late 80s, and I've written about her. I mean, I have many patients like this, but, you know, modern medicine, even though she's even though she has probably a year or 2 years to live, it could be longer, could be shorter. You know, medicine would like her to go to the ER every time she has a problem, have a pill for every body part, you know, more chemotherapy at the expense of her mental health and quality of life. I mean, I'm not trying to demonize all of medicine. Medicine is doing a good job in a lot of ways, but I'm just saying, like, where we fail patients, particularly oncology patients, is treating the cancer in her case and not the person. So my job with this patient is to not deprive her of chemotherapy if she wants it, of course, but to assess the benefits of chemotherapy with the harms of being a chronic patient in the ER because of side effects. Weaving in the family so that everyone's on the same page, so our goals and our mission and our visions and values are aligned. Because guess what? Acceptance has to include that we are mortal and that we cannot, that, like, there's no menu option for her of surviving this cancer. That's not on the menu, unfortunately. There's certain cancers that are survivable. There are certain cancers that are not. I'm not trying to suggest that's an easy thing to swallow. I'm just saying that when we can accept that, you know, in this case, mortality, and accept that in her case, quality of life matters as much as quantity. And then, by the way, you look at the data, Adrienne, the data are clear in the oncology space. And talk to my friend Sunita Puri, who's an oncologist who's written extensively and studied this phenomenon extensively. People who are given options and agency at the end of their life and who sometimes that includes declining the chemotherapy, live longer. So not surprisingly, the mind-body connection at play is about giving people agency, giving people choices, and not treating them as a set of body parts, but rather as a human being. Yeah. And that's the beautiful part of medicine, but we have to change the system for it to, for that right. to even begin to be possible for every person in America. And well, it's not, and I'll be dead before the system. I mean, talk about acceptance. I've accepted the fact that I will be dead before medicine treats people like that. And when it's affordable for all people, it's just not. I mean, 80 million Americans don't have a primary care doctor. The ER is the primary care for most people. It's just so broken and it's so sad. And there's such disparities between people who can afford doctors who can pay attention and people who can't. And it's awful. It's part of why I'm writing this book, is to reach more people beyond the walls of my office. Not that I'm God's gift to medicine. I mean, I'm as flawed as they come as well. It's just that, you know, we got to stop thinking that health is this outcome and that there's a guru out there who can tell you, who can prescribe right. something. There's no prescription.
No. Well, I love so much of what you said too, because I think similarly along the lines when working with like leaders or practice owners, you know, or physician executives like there's a unique outcome for all of us. Like what success looks like, what your vision looks like is going to be different, but ultimately, and I often use the words, it's a no judgment zone. Like there should be opportunities to have the conversations. And one of the things that we see most often is when the team's not working, when there's not consistency around that effort, one of the key pieces of people feeling like they have input into decisions that affect their work and affect their life. And
it's agency.
Yeah. And agency. I love that word. And so, you know, trying to create these like changes to make your system, your practice, you know, your interactions with patients as physicians, like the most valuable in connection with your patients. Sometimes it means longer visits. Sometimes it's just those moments of truly being present and asking those questions and creating the systems that can actually help support and give you that space to do that. It's so key. And I think as leaders, being able to, you know, awareness, I love that, awareness of where things are, acceptance of what is and what can't be changed, or at least what can't be changed today, or maybe in the immediate future. Yeah. And exactly. then really like, okay, what do we do now? What do we do now? And doing that together, it's just, you know, from a stress and burnout perspective, taking that all off of any one person's leader or team member or otherwise shoulder. So
it's agency. You know, what do we all want in life, right? I think we all kind of want the same things, right? We want to be loved. We want to be fed. We want to be sheltered. We want to have some sense of meaning and purpose. And when people feel like they have meaning and purpose, particularly in their health lives and in their own bodies, and then at work, for example, that's where people are. They shine, right? Like when they're deprived of agency, whether it's because their doctor shamed them for being overweight and said, you know, inappropriate things, or even accidentally shamed them, but or they don't have agency at work. It's just a recipe for burnout. So as you just said, Adrienne, it's not so simple. Acceptance is not so simple, right? Like that's the hardest part of being human: accepting mortality, accepting that we're not going to live through this cancer, accepting that we have a genetic predisposition to breast cancer, accepting that we had childhood trauma or that someone mistreated us. That's a hard thing. How do you get the help and how do you get the change started? How do you switch from acceptance to then the agency is really the recipe for success. And not everybody's fortunate to have this, but as you were just touching on, it's rooted in trust of the guide or the leader, right? So trust is the glue, right, of any relationship.
Yeah.
Right. So trust is born out of, it's not arbitrary, right? Like people, like I trust people, I'm sure you're the same way. Like I trust people who are humble, who know what they don't know, or they're trying to know what they don't know, who are willing to acknowledge they've made mistakes and who listen. And so if you have a doctor who can do those things for you, if you have a therapist, if you have a support, you know, person in your life, who's non-judgmental, humble, listening, and is not judging you, as I said in the beginning, that's where you can, that's how you start to crack open the ability for people to start accepting things they can't control. But without that leadership, it's pretty difficult, right? I mean, look at medicine right now. People are so distrusting. People are at record stats on distrust of public health institutions right now. I mean, we have a measles epidemic domestically and around the world because of distrust in medical institutions, vaccines, et cetera. How do you build back that trust? Well, we should have more humility, in my humble opinion, about the mistakes we made in the pandemic. We should have more humility about the fact that people are smart and people see that kids were not at particularly high risk for COVID. Of course, some people were. Some kids have tragically, of course, died from COVID. We also made some mistakes in the way we messaged risk. My patient who's, you know, in her 90s in a nursing home with end-stage cancer is at very different risk from a teenager who's already had COVID, right? Having humility in medicine and in public health would add huge value in terms of people's trust of institutions, trust of doctors. Same thing with any leader, whether it's you or me. If you can listen and provide, you know, that sort of safe space, as they say, that's the birthplace of health.
Yeah. No, I think the humility, I also often find myself saying the word vulnerability, you know, being like in the transparency word. And I think a lot of times, you know, as humans, leaders, physician, you know, there's that degree of what and when to be transparent about. And again, you don't have to share everything and there's ways to have those conversations, but building that opportunity for the vulnerability and connection, whether it's one-on-one with a colleague or a patient or your spouse or, you know, your family member or friend, like being able to say like, you know, here's where I am, here's what's important to me, here's what I'm experiencing, here's where I would like things to shift, or I don't want things to be this way, I don't want things to feel that way, and being able to have those conversations. And I think the other part of the agency, and as you know, we've both been in different organizations and then, you know, transitioned out of those, is, you know, at some point, as you've done what you feel you can to have those conversations, to show up in that way, to shift things.
Yes.
At some point you have to make the choice to shift your environment and or those that you're around. What are your thoughts on how did you
I think the vulnerability is so crucial. I think it sort of goes hand in hand with humility, right? Like doctors who claim that they are morally that they are moral authorities are kind of setting themselves up for failure. Like if I sort of looked down the tip of my nose and pretended like I didn't have my own challenges medically or emotionally, right? Then that would be like that would be the death rattle of like of a relationship, right? At the same time, I don't need to share my dirty laundry with all of my patients, but if I can say to a patient who's struggling with his or her relationship with alcohol, for example, and instead of saying, "Gosh, you really need to quit. You're kind of a mess," no, I would say, "Look, I love alcohol like the best of them too. I love it too." And it's like, this is not a moral discussion. It's not a, like, there's not a character flaw. This is me trying to help you advocate for yourself, you know, and it's the vulnerability. And then when you're talking about making changes in the workplace or in any sphere of life, when you're talking about making changes and you're working with other people and trying to achieve change sort of in a system. Yeah. I mean, one of the more powerful things when you're trying to help someone see your point of view or to understand their point of view is to be like, yeah, this is like, I'm right. Like, I feel like this conversation is making me feel like a little it's just a little destabilizing. It makes me a little anxious. Mm-hmm. I also realize like you know, just say how you feel. Like, it's okay. Like, if you say that I'm feeling like this conversation is like a little intimidating, or this makes me feel intimidated. It may not be your intent, but it's intimidating. I wonder what you think about that. That's very powerful, right? To acknowledge how you feel without blaming or shaming or dumping on other people.
Right.
Yeah.
That's huge. And being able to say, and I think the other element of that is, and you referenced it too. And again, I think about it as a leader and I think about it as a human or someone who's, you know, been in a relationship that wasn't working, is there is only so much when you recognize like where you want things to shift, or you perhaps would like someone else to change how they're responding, that there's only so much that you can do. I think you are responsible for clarifying what we want, what we need more of, less of, and being able to communicate that as best as we can in those moments, or giving ourselves time and space to try it again. But ultimately, that significant other, that employee, that partner, whatever it is, like, they have to get there.
We cannot change. We are not responsible for other people's feelings, right? We are not responsible for other people's feelings. And I think the mistake that a lot of women make, and I think men do this too, of course, but we're talking about women. We are women. I think the mistake that a lot of women make and leaders make is that they can fix other people's problems and fix and like correct people's internal narratives, when that alone can breed burnout. Like, trying to make someone see that the sky is blue is very difficult. If they want to think it's purple, they're going to think it's purple, and that they have to do their own work to see that the sky is blue. And to try to convince someone of that is difficult. And I will actually say that to a patient, for example, in a nicer way than that, but like, I have a patient who's married to an alcoholic. I can say this because I have so many patients that are married to alcoholics that it's anonymizing just in and of itself. So we had a conversation just this week about how she's trying so hard to convince her husband's family that there's a problem, to convince him he has a problem, to compensate for all the things that are going wrong in their family life. And I said to her, look, I hear you. I get it. But you're over functioning, and your compensatory stuff is its own problem. It's not the problem. He is not an alcoholic because of you. It actually has nothing to do with you. It's an addiction. So my best advice is to realize what you cannot change. I mean, by the way, the serenity prayer for alcoholism is this whole thing. Like, realize what you can't, right? It's like, give me the wisdom to know the difference between what I can change and not change. And liberate yourself from this narrative that you can change him, that you can change his addiction, that you have more power over alcoholism and the family dynamics around it. And give yourself permission to get a really good therapist who's going to help you hold better boundaries with him and with yourself, and to advocate for yourself. And that is where I'm going to help you with your blood pressure and your sleep. There's no Prozac, girlfriend, that's going to fix that. Unfortunately, no. I mean, Prozac might give you some floors to manage all the anxiety, but it's, again, it's beyond the prescription. It's about agency. It's about acceptance. So yes, you cannot change other people, whether it's in a relationship, like at work or at home. You cannot change other people. You can try, but that can lead to burnout itself.
Well, and I think, as you said, you know, we're women and overfunctioning. We've both had our stints of that, still do at times.
Yeah.
I know I have many male executive clients and physician executives, or, you know, physicians that I've worked with too, who they also have gotten, I think it can happen to anyone.
It totally can. It's not gendered. It's just, I see it more commonly in women. I just do. This is anecdata. And I see it, and I just do. It's absolutely true. There are men who are like, I hope these are my sons. I have young adult children who are empaths and problem solvers and listening, sometimes at their own expense. Like, they're so empathetic that they get trampled on by the gals. And I'm not just talking about my boys. I'm just talking about in general. Yes, this applies to anybody. The point being that you cannot control other people's feelings. You cannot control other people's internal narratives. And there's a liberation in accepting that.
Yeah.
And being honest with yourself about that. And then picking a path for yourself that isn't rooted in this idea of changing someone else.
Yeah. And I think realizing when to, I always get the visual of like, you're getting to the new place you want to be, and you're trying to drag and pull someone else, pull the team, pull the person, you know, along with you, and just how heavy that
is. Exhausting.
And, you know, realizing that you've done what you can, and like making that decision to let go. I think that's something that, whether it's, you know, a new job, a new boss, a new project or a new person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also realizing that things, like the perfectionism there too, has to go away too. Like, there is no, you know, knight in shining armor or perfect job or perfect business partner or perfect, you know, work-life balance. Again, it's all process. It's really just picking your poison, right? It's like, pick you know, it's like I say to patients about treating depression, for example, the goal here isn't to make you happy all the time. Yeah. It's like parenting. My job as a parent isn't to delight you and make everything hunky-dory all the time. It's to diminish pain. It's like harm reduction, right? It's like this concept in public health of like risk is everywhere. Harms are everywhere. It is the goal of medicine and public health, and the goal of in my mind, being an effective human being, is recognizing where there's risk, recognizing what your tolerances for risk are, and then accepting the things you can't control, and then working on the places you can without perfectionism, without thinking that you can do it alone, and with a heavy dose of humility.
Yeah. No, I love that. And really being able to just build those. I think, again, it's about the connections and realizing what you want, and not everyone may fill the same role.
That's right.
In your life forever, right? Like there's a process, there's a journey, and people are there, and there's lessons to be learned, and there's pieces to take away. But ultimately, you have to continue to just, it is a constant process of reassessing.
Reassessing. It's iterative. I mean, science is iterative. Being human is an iterative process. We learn from our mistakes, right? Like failure is the key to success. They say it all the time. Is that easy? No. Is it fun seeing your kids struggle, feeling yourself burned out, feeling yourself trying to correct someone else's internal narrative that's rooted in, you know, not real news? No, it's hard, but that's the process. The other thing, what you touched on really quickly at the end here is, you know, my goal for my patients is not about me, right? It's about them. So like you may, as a person, want to, you have a bit different vision for what your health and life looks like. Like you may not need or want your diabetes to be so tightly controlled that you can never have a piece of cake on your birthday. Like that may not be quality of life for you. It wouldn't be for me.
Right.
You may want such tight control of your diabetes because that gives you comfort and gives you the absolute best shot at not having the vascular micro damage from, you know, high blood sugars. In other words, whether it's an organization or an individual, people's visions and missions are different, and that's okay. I toggle between world domination. Like I want this to be a best-selling podcast and a best-selling book, and I want to be on like the TED stage. And then other days I'm like, I have nothing to prove. I'm not here to like, for my ego. I'm here to help other people conceptualize their health in a little different way and maybe see some light bulbs go on. And so then I'm like, you know what? It's just basically about doing the best I can and snuggling with my kids and seeing them grow into these amazing people, working with people like you and, you know, getting outside, getting back to my exercise, which I desperately need to do, you know, and that's actually what I want to do is just be balanced. Right. Cause that's health to me.
And I think I've described it recently as like feeling like you're almost kind of coming home to yourself and who you are and what you want.
Yes.
And allowing the beauty of, you know, sharing that with those that are in your life and, you know, helping them, whatever work or life otherwise, but also allowing them to, you know, recognize like they're creating their own journey and yours gets to evolve. Like yours gets to look different today, tomorrow, 5 years from now. So to that point, to kind of wrap us up, what's one thing that you're really excited to create over the next year?
I am so excited. Oh my gosh, do not even get me started, Adrienne, but I am so excited because I have so much passion for this stuff. I am so excited to build a place. I already have this Substack newsletter, right? That's reaching a lot of people every week with narratives and stories and data about health in a more nuanced way. My goal ultimately is to continue to see patients and to write this book and then to basically reach more people by having some courses, some online curricula for people to conceptualize their health in a different way and take their own journey, not just with me, because I'm one person and I'm not the only person, but to help people build a bit of a house of health for themselves. Build their house of health so that they have their kitchen cabinet, their team of people they need to manage the different elements of their health, nutritional, behavioral, relationship-wise, work-wise, for them to be their best self. So that's what I want to do, and that's what I will do. it's not going to be overnight. It's going to take time. And, you know, if it's only, I have one client and it's like my husband, that's fine too. not that he's the best thing ever, but I'm saying if it's not a world domination as the end game, that's fine. I just want to do it because it's fun.
Yeah. I feel the same way. My book is far behind yours, but I feel the same way. I'm like, I just want to share the stories, the experience. Yes. Ultimately, you know, I've told my team, like, if it die tomorrow, like it's publishable at this point. It's not where I want it to be. It doesn't have quite the feel that I want, but ultimately it's like being able to share what you've gone through, which is what I hope this podcast is doing too, is being able to share with others. Cause we all have so many similar experiences. There's different people in the, you know, that happened at different times, but ultimately, you know, but at the same time, it's really easy to feel like you're in it alone. I think really being able to know, like, oh, that I always, you know, when I'm speaking and you probably see the same thing, you share a story and everybody kind of looks around like, oh, thank goodness. Isn't just me.
Yeah. That's not just, just me. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, this is why we're doing what we do, is because there's a lot of unmet needs, and some of that is in medicine and healthcare. Some of it is in leadership. And we're all at the end of the day, kind of the same. Like, we all want the same things: to be seen, loved, fed, housed, have some sense of purpose and meaning. We all want to be respected. Yeah. And life is hard, and it's hard in different ways for different people. And it doesn't have to be, this journey doesn't have to be expensive, fancy, you know, or on some algorithm. It can be nuanced, and it can be about the individual's, you know, particular mission. So whatever it is, I'm following you, and we are, you know, I'm taking my cue from Adrian.
No, well, thank
because,
you.
But I'll have what she's having.
Well, I think likewise, I think, you know, it's some of my most favorite moments over the last few years, kind of being more in the entrepreneurial space too. Some of the times it's just the most quiet moments, you know, those moments of kind of like with one person. And I think in life, and, you know, as a parent and a human, it's really those like moments of pausing and just, you know, being grateful and also being hopeful at the same time of what's out there and what's to come. And
last thing I'll say really quick, and not to interrupt you, is I had this great conversation with my daughter, who's 18, and she was having a stressful day, and she's a real achiever and hard worker, and she's a great young woman. And she said, oh God, I'm just stressed about school, and she's in a relationship. And I said, Stelly, why don't you just take the weekend to just kind of rest and relax and like be outside? And she goes, Mom, I don't need you to solve the problem. I just need you to listen.
Yeah.
And I said, oh my gosh, my little Buddha. I said, noted.
Yeah.
And I hear you. And that, thank you for saying that, because now I'm going to say to her, do you need me to listen, or do you need me to problem solve? Because sometimes people, you don't know what you don't know. And I think that humility and then awareness of other people is power.
Yeah. Well, and what a gift. I think it's a parent. I think you've gotten there, and I feel like I've made tremendous progress over the last few years of when you are more aware and you're reflecting, you're pausing, and you're having those moments.
Pausing.
Ability to ask the question. And as a leader too, you know, the ability to ask the question of like, help me understand like why this happened.
Help me understand.
How we can get there. What do you need from me to be supported? I had my 11-year-old the other day. I was like, Mom, you're just such a happy person. And meanwhile, she had literally seen me crying. I'm selling the house. It's a whole process. And, you know, she had seen me crying a couple hours before. And
yeah.
I mean, I'm definitely not always a happy person, but I think, you know, it's like we talked about, like you have a choice in the agency part. Like you have a choice of how you, you know, take those moments in, the things that are happening to you, around you, and like what you choose to then do next. And I think that's what's just so beautiful about what you're empowering patients to do and others to do. And hopefully we did a little bit of today. So
thanks, Adrian. It's so fun to talk to you as always.
Thank you for joining us. All right, everyone. And we'll have Lucy's information below if you want to sign up for her newsletter or visit some of the other amazing things she's doing on her website. And then we'll also have link to her practice. If you do happen to be in the DC area, can take a look. All right.
Thank you, Adrian. Great to see you.
Me too.
The popular buzzword we've been seeing everywhere is AI. But what we all want to know is how we can implement and use it to our advantage when it comes to improving margins, accelerating cash flow, and optimizing staff performance. There's a one-stop shop using cloud-based predictive analytics. MGMA Analytics is your AI-enabled tool that upscales technology you've already been paying for, so you can silo your disparate systems and make data-backed business decisions. Visit mgma.com/analytics and see how AI can revolutionize your finances and operations. Again, visit mgma.com/analytics today.